My name's Howard Olson from St. Paul, Minnesota. I think most of you were here yesterday, so I don't know, we need to reintroduce ourselves and give you a little, hear ourselves coming and going. Today I'd like to begin in a little different manner. I want you to think about a few things. In other words, the renewability of trees as a basic resource came to mind about 15 years ago when the energy crisis started, and they realized after all the supply of oil, coal, and all the other minerals is depleting and is not renewable. So all of a sudden all the wood people in the world and the foresters and everybody got real excited because they got some new attention they'd never had before. And that spread worldwide, and I'm going to show you a few references today that I've been using as soon as we get into this. This is a book that came to my attention last year, and it tells what's going on in the world pretty well on all types of resources. And this one here on World Resources, 1988 and 89, also goes through all of the general subjects of worldwide concern. And we keep getting in later years more and more about pollution and this type of thing. And I thought I ought to start you off with a little sense of humor again today, because a story came up about these three foresters, the Swede and the Norwegian and the Finlander, and they were suddenly found themselves marooned on a desert island somewhere, and they'd been there for some time, and they were getting very hungry and shaggy and everything, and all of a sudden a genie appeared before him, and the genie said, "You each get one wish, and no matter what it is, it'll be granted." So the Norwegian said, "Oh boy, to be back in Oslo and eating some torsk, that'd be great." He was right back there in Oslo. And the Swede said, "I want to be back in Stockholm with my girlfriend and have a nice time there and everything." And zing, he was back in Stockholm. They came to the Finlander and he said, "Boy, it sure is lonely here. I wish my friends were back." That's probably that same Finlander that was got hired by the highway department in northern Minnesota. We got a lot of Finlanders up there. Miss Toivia got a job painting the yellow line on the highway. So the first day he painted a mile of yellow line, and they thought, "Boy, we got a real world beater here." The second day he only painted a half mile, and the third day a quarter of a mile, and they called him in and said, "Toivia, what seemed to be the matter? You started like a whirlwind the first day." And he says, "Well, you got to realize I'm getting farther away from the paint pail." Well, that's worldwide.
Yeah, right.
Thought what I'd do today to really get us in the right frame of mind here is just read a little bit from this World Watch to set your mind on what we're talking about. They phrase this about as well as anybody can figure it out on the status of where we're at on reforesting the earth, and that's what we're talking about, using the renewability of the trees that we're dealing with here worldwide. "Before the dawn of agriculture, some 10,000 years ago, the earth boasted a rich mantle of forest and open woodland, covering roughly 7.2 billion hectares." A hectare is what, 2.2 acres? Okay, anybody give it to me? It's about that,
yeah.
2.2 acres. So here you got 12 billion acres. "Over time, a combination of land clearing for crop production, fuel wood gathering, commercial timber harvesting, and cattle ranching has caused the Earth's forest to shrink back to some 4.1 billion hectares, a third less than existed. For centuries, this reduction in the Earth's biological stock hindered human progress little, if at all. Indeed, the clearing of trees to expand food production and the harvesting of forest products were vital aspects of economic and social development. But in recent years, the relentless loss of tree cover has begun to impinge directly on the economic and environmental health of numerous nations, mostly in the Third World. Combined with concerted efforts to protect remaining forests, large-scale reforestation, a seeming anomaly for a planet where woody vegetation still covers 40% of the land, now appears essential to improving the human prospect. In some of the other reading, it says we got 40% in woody plants, but they're not the kind of woody plants that we had originally that we want. It's changing. Most tree planting efforts over the last several decades have aimed at increasing supplies of marketable timber, pulp, and fuel wood for cities, wood products that yield tangible economic benefits. By contrast, reforestation for reasons that lie outside the monetized economy has been vastly underattended. Yet trees quite literally form the roots of many natural systems. With the inexorable march of deforestation, the ecological integrity of many areas is disintegrating, causing severe soil loss, aggravating droughts and floods, disrupting water supplies, and reducing land productivity. Trees are also a vital component of the survival economy of the rural poor. Hundreds of millions of people rely on gathered wood to cook their meals and heat their homes. For them, lack of access to wood translates into reduced living standards, in some cases, directly into malnutrition. In addition, trees and soils play a crucial role in the global recycling or global cycling of carbon, the importance of which has been magnified by the emergence of carbon dioxide-induced climate change as arguably the most threatening environmental problem of modern times. Efforts to slow deforestation certainly deserve redoubled support, but even if forest clearing miraculously ceased today, millions of hectares of trees would still have to be planted to meet future fuel wood needs and to stabilize soil and water resources. Increased planting to satisfy rising demands for paper, lumber, and other industrial wood products, though less daunting a task, is also crucial. Expanding forest cover for all these reasons will reduce pressure on remaining virgin forest stands, helping to preserve habitats and thereby safeguard the Earth's biological diversity. A number of organizations now are hanging on that phrase, biological diversity. The Society of American Foresters that meets once a year in some city in the United States, in the last two meetings, they've really been big on biological diversity. And I guess basically that brings in all the components that are acting on the biology we're dealing with. At the same time, it would mitigate the buildup of atmospheric carbon dioxide, which gives industrial countries sound reason to step up support for tree planting in the Third World. Successful reforesting large areas of degraded lands, however, will require much more than financial commitments from governments and international lending agencies. It will take effective coordination with numerous local groups in starting nurseries in thousands of villages and encouraging the planting of multi-purpose trees along roads, on farms, and around houses. Only by garnering the knowledge, support, and energy of rural people themselves and planting to meet their basic needs is there any hope of success of such a wide program. Tree cover trends. Dramatic changes in regional forest cover historically reflect powerful societal transformations. Beginning in the 16th century, the expanding agriculture and industrial needs of the Renaissance societies spurred the clearing of large tracts of forest in Western Europe, both the French and English, so depleted their domestic forest resources that they were forced by the mid-17th century to conduct a worldwide search for ship timber. It goes on, you know, to tell about how France and England were both fully wooded in the beginning and society coming in and as the populations grew, they cut down all the trees. They point out several other important points here. Fortunately, reforestation is also proceeding somewhat faster than the official estimates suggest. A recent study estimated that in 1980, plantations covered 11.5 million hectares in tropical countries. excluding China, nearly two-thirds of which produced wood for industrial purposes. Half of these industrial plantations were in tropical Asia, primarily in India and Indonesia. Less than one-sixth were in tropical Africa. They projected that during the early 80s, industrial plantations would expand at an annual rate of 581,000 hectares each, while fuel wood and other non-industrial plantations would grow by 519,000 hectares. Estimated planting rates varied greatly, with Brazil topping the list at roughly 449,000 hectares per year. By the end of 1985, plantations were projected to cover some 17 million hectares in the tropics, an area roughly twice the size of Austria. Now, what's happened since then? This was published in 1988, and I think some of the information came in probably 86 and 87. So things have changed a little bit since their forecasts. You've been reading more and more of deforestation, and particularly in Brazil. There's been a great deal of deforestation in Brazil in this one valley, and it's not meeting the stated reasons. The reasons are they want to open the land up for agriculture, and like happened many other places, once they got the trees cut and they got down to the soil and burned it all off, it turned out not to be good agricultural soil after all. In the meantime, they sold all the logs, which is, I think, the politicians were after in the beginning, and they've left the natives without much to live on. There's some very vast areas of Brazil right now that are being badly cut over. And that's the reason I put up this map here. It's pinpointing the growing threats to our endangered earth. They name all these various impacting things we have. I just run through them. Population pressure, air pollution, the ozone concerns, acid rain, water pollution, water diversion, toxic wastes, radiation perils, species extinctions, fisheries depletion, deforestation, desertification. Is that the way you pronounce it?
No.
Desertification. That means that areas that once had vegetation suddenly are becoming deserts. In certain parts of the world, that's happening all too rapidly. They've got the numbers, and they've put the numbers on the map of where it's occurring. Deforestation, I'll read you what it says under that. If my bifocals will allow me here, I may have to stand on his chair. Life's greatest storehouse, tropical forests, shrink annually by an estimated 80,000 of their total 10 million square miles. Now, they're talking 80,000 square miles, not 80,000 acres. That is a vast piece of land. Through expanding agriculture, logging, and development, demand for fuel has denuded African woodland and slopes in Haiti and Nepal, where erosion, landslides, and floods have increased, and no cover may remain by 2020. Costa Rica, on the other hand, has preserved some tropical ecosystems. They put these number 11 to correspond with that. I've put a couple pins in here. You can see in Brazil. And in Africa, primarily, Brazil, Africa, and Nepal. Those are the main ones. You can look at that map after if you'd like to a little bit. But this thing in Brazil has gone very fast, and I think some of you read the, who's the hamburger place that was growing beef where they cut down all the trees in Brazil, and they were going to bar protest against the Big Mac, as they said, from trees to hamburger. They were raising cattle down there to get the cheaper beef than they could raise in the United States. So they got a lot of bad publicity on that. Here's another map that shows it just a little better. It says nowhere to hide, and it shows the desertification in areas where there's too much cutting going on. And they say quite the same thing. Just read another part here where it says that air and water water pollution, including acid rain, ocean pollution is now a worldwide problem. Acid rain, a byproduct of the combustion of fossil fuels, has ruined freshwater lakes in eastern states. A much more serious effect still being studied is the pollution damage to forests. Destruction of tropical forests, both for wood and conversion to agriculture, approximately 27.2 million acres are permanently lost each year. Now, when they say permanently, that means they aren't being replanted, and probably can't be. The immediate consequence of deforestation is the extinction of insects, plants, and animals whose habitat is destroyed. An estimated one-fifth of all species on Earth may disappear over the next 20 years. And that's because the total ecosystem is all disrupted, and animals and plants and bugs and everything else no longer live there. Desertification of crop grazing and forest land due to overuse, an estimated 14.8 million acres of new desert are formed each year, most of it in the Saharan Africa. And the map shows the areas again, quite similar to that, where this is all occurring. Without going too much further into that, I'd like to see if you have any questions right now on the world situation or any of these references, and then try to get back to a little more of what we're doing in the United States.
You talk about trees as the renewable resource. Are there other elements or factors beyond trees in the way of components of the atmosphere of the earth that we are not now renewing that could be renewed? In the sense that the technology would permit it, setting aside the cost.
No. Not really. The only thing, in essence, it's not, quote, renewing, but the air and the water can be looked at sort of as a renewable resource once you clean up the pollution.
Yeah.
And there is technology exists to do that. Okay? But as far as the hard, you know, any ores or anything, no, once it's gone, it's gone.
Unless we want to go on to eons and eons of ages and ages, you know.
Right.
And go back to when the coal originally was trees in the ancient history, you know.
I was really begging a different kind of question, I suppose. Talking about the use of lumber for paper as a significant component of the requirement for trees.
You mean as trees as a significant component of paper?
Whatever. We are perhaps 100 years away, I don't know if it would be that long, maybe less, from probably eliminating most requirements for paper. Paper now, as opposed to packaging. Paper as used in a writing sense.
For newspaper?
Newspaper, writing paper, whatever. I think 100 years is very reasonable to assume that we will be worldwide an electronic society in that period of time. And that automatically reduces some water requirements for those trees that don't need to be made into paper.
Yeah.
And frees up an additional component of trees for oxygen production and so on. I'm trying to sense a geometry here with one small dent in the problem in one of the critical resources, having some synergy, you know,
they didn't cut trees down for one if they leave the trees growing, although some of the studies now, younger trees give off more oxygen than older trees. So the idea of more and more plantations is not a bad one either. And it also, of course, studies in the wildlife pretty good. One of these long-range studies in here showing to the third world nations and as they develop says that the demand for paper is going to be greatly enlarged about 50 years from now. says countries like China that are using very little per capita paper suddenly might be using a lot of it.
You've got a blip, no question, as the third world educational levels and the like seek to catch up. But they'll catch up geometrically because of electronics and because of communications and because of computing. And so they'll skip several iterations that we in the West have gone through, accelerated, you know, with the use of that paper. And they'll be moving into an electronic component much sooner relative to their total developmental
stage. Well, you'd hope so, but who knows? They're going to go through all these various stages. And even now, in the U.S., they start talking to us about using less paper. The U.S. paper demand keeps going up every year, too. Hasn't yet started to go down, which it might. But when you think worldwide in 1975, when they really put the emphasis on oil, the automobile or transportation industry has used more oil now every single year since 75. That's 15 years where they're draining that resource. And whether they like it or not, they want to keep their cars running. They're going to have to figure out to get more miles per gallon and such.
The key, of course, is for the industrial user is going to be the cost trade-offs. You know, where's the biggest bang for the buck relative to what we've got to lay out? I work for the Boeing company who makes airplanes. We are going through a tremendous conversion to move our internal affairs to video teleconferencing and eliminate the need for Boeing managers to travel on airplanes.
Sure.
We're already in the lead technologically to create this capability. We'll end up by selling it worldwide. We're already doing a little bit of that. But first and foremost is to take 15,000 managers and keep them in their office 8 hours a day. Not on airplanes, even though we sell airplane tickets. And this is only an example of, I think...
Putting yourself out of business.
No, we're moving into a higher technology business at all times. Right. We'll eventually be an information processor, not an airplane maker at all. It's a matter of time.
One question I had, Howard, is that I don't understand if we are, the paper is increasing and everything, why isn't used paper recyclable? I mean, can't even give it away these days. You can't get anything for it, so therefore there's no recycling of newspapers.
Now, Ansel can probably answer this better than I can because he worked for a large paper company, a warehouser, all types of timber uses. But I was on this one board where there were three presidents of three paper companies, and they said, we ought to make the proceedings on recycled paper. And these guys all just groaned. They said, what do you mean we're in the paper business? What are I going to put on recycled paper? You know, and that gets into a real ethical question.
Yeah, because, you know, aluminum, you recycle the cans, you're saving 95% of the energy.
So far, they're able to do it to about 50%. If they get the mix greater than that, the quality of the paper goes down. But they are using, and depending on the mill, if you've got a fine paper mill, your usage is very small.
Of recycling?
Yes. If you get a craft mill like the Springfield mill, they'll go as high as 60%. So it depends on the output.
But so you use the key word, quality. Quality is a very complex notion that's beauty in the eye of the beholder. At a point in time where the cultural ethic will be to use a recycled item, that fine paper will be anathema. Mm-hmm. It will be to be abhorred, and to be striven away from. See, right now it's got some kind of appeal. Same thing with trees. 40 years ago, we moved into a housing subdivision where the way you built it was to level the earth, take out every tree, put in a little ticky-tacky box, sure, and plant some petunias. Now, at least where I live, people go to untold lengths to avoid cutting a tree down in the construction
sure.
and immediately plant more trees. Immediately. And the house without trees, just with a lot of expansive lawn and some little picket fence and petunias, they're viewed as nerds.
Yeah.
You know, people that have no conception at all of a proper lifestyle.
We do the same thing.
So attitudinally can change what quality
is. To get back to your main question, a lot of these things come about by factors impacting on them. One factor that impacts, of course, is the economics of papermaking, but the other factor is, like, what species of tree we're going to use. If spruce gets too expensive, which it is right now, they'll try to use more pine. If they can use aspen, and that's still less expensive, they'll try to use some of that. If they can get some recycle in there and work in the process, and the economics will impact it and tell them. But until it happens, they're very reluctant to do it for other reasons. They're getting a lot of public pressure now to use more recycled paper, but you know, this has been going on for 10 years, and we still we're not using much recycled paper. The other thing is, when you get your Sunday paper and it's that thick, you know, everybody throws away about 2/3 of it. So why don't we get some decent substance?
Yeah, they do something right now which is helping the trees. They've almost eliminated plywood. And I think it's just a matter of years before they're all out of plywood, and they'll be into the
particle board.
Yeah, particle board or strand board or oriented strand board.
And there's some other.
But then you've got another problem, and you use a lot of resins, and there you're in the oil or coal business.
Right. They're using some of this composition wood now too, aren't they? They thought they had an idea to take all the used railroad ties that they're pulling on these rails and, you know, grind them up and use them. And that didn't work too well either. Yes?
Now, on this recycling paper, you use that. A week or so ago, I read in the paper about the recyclable paper to use for these coffee filters.
Sure.
Now they found something wrong with them. They said that it causes some.
Probably the coffee doesn't taste any good.
Well, they say it probably
causes cancer or something else.
Some disease causes something sick.
Sounds like that old story about the company that developed this great campaign to sell dog food, and they had spent millions on advertising, packaging, and everything, and it didn't sell, and they said, what was the matter? Is that the dogs didn't like it. That sounds like the same deal.
Of course, sir, Archer Daniels Midland is in producing cups now instead of styrofoam, and it looks like a degradable cup, which should be good. Good for.
It'll be good. No, all these paper bags now that they'll deteriorate, biodegradable, like grocery bags.
Mm-hmm. Most of them are photodegradable, aren't they? They have to be out in the sunlight.
Oh, I see, yeah, probably.
Or Archer Daniels Midland says they can bury the stuff, you know.
It'll biodegrade it.
Then you get a big slump.
Well, as we know, there's no easy answer to any of this, but I think public opinion has a way of coming around, so it gets everybody's attention. But it takes a combination of legislation and public opinion, as we said yesterday, the day before, to get really large-scale planning going on, or planting of more and more trees. It's going to take legislators that have got some vision. A lot of these people don't think that far ahead, and they're struggling. I've been in some sessions, too, where, you know, they're struggling with so many dollars, and they don't want to spend some that aren't going to show for 20 years or 30 years. Unless they get a program that works that way, the way the Swedes have
done. I think the real difference today that's in our favor, and it's an element of my comment about what Boeing is doing, is instantaneous electronic audiovisual communication worldwide, whether you're talking a native village in Sumatra or within civilized environments, first world environments. So you can mount that cause. You can show Chernobyl in all its horrible detail instantly worldwide. They talk about the cloud impact, the radioactive fallout impact, and energize people in public opinion virtually overnight. That might have taken a generation, just a generation ago or so.
But just talking kind of church-wise or policy-wise or ethically for a moment, what it really takes in our leaders that are sold on something like this. I'm not either Democrat or Republican, but Ronald Reagan just did not take the leadership he could have taken. Carter started doing some of these things, but Reagan kind of put them all on the back burner all the time, and for 8 years nothing happened. In fact, he withdrew a lot of good social programs that were finally making headway. We had a speaker up here last year, a doctor that had shown that, for instance, I like things that are concrete where they got a good result. They had a prenatal program in California for unwed mothers or young mothers and so forth, and their mortality on children was so different from 75 to 80. At 80, they cut the program off, and suddenly they're getting deformed babies and dead babies, everything else. See, and it was one of these programs that really made some sense. Well, to throw something like that out is crazy. And some of these other natural resource programs are the same way. They cut back budgets that you wouldn't believe. And that's what it takes. I think it's going to take some real statesman, you know, leadership of that scope that'll bring these things up to the attention of the world and put them into effect.
I think every national forest had to come out with a, 10-year plan.
Yep.
And I saw the Willamette and some of the bigger ones, and they really beat them around there for quite a few years. I think it was 4 or 5 years before they finally had them out. And they do make sense. There's some good thinking in those.
If you want to read the one in the Wenatchee Forest, where you are right now, it's on file up here in the museum, about that thick.
Yeah.
But they work on those for 5 years to get them into shape. And there again, that's where our electronic age is going to help us. You know this better than I do about getting things on the computer and getting what the water is, what the growth per acre is, what the species are, what the everything there, you can dial it out in a moment. If every state in America had that type of thing, you'd have something going. Here's a book that I came across here, for instance, Environmental Pollution in Montana. A whole book telling what they're going to have to do about it for one single state. That could be a model now for some other states, and that's what's happening with some of these things. And that's probably the way it'll start it. If some state will get a good growing program or a good replanting program that works, they can probably disseminate to other states and see what happens. The southern states, as far as getting back to renewable resource, the best example is right down in the southeastern part of the United States, because timber grows fast, and they plant a lot down there all the time. It pays to plant. It pays to do the latest genetics, the best seed source, and the best soil conditioning and fertilization, the best nurseries, and it's been proven. So it's possible.
They've done a lot with the super tree, too. If they'll go in the forest and pick out the best cones, and they'll even mark the elevation they were picked at.
Yeah, altitude.
And they'll raise those things, and they've got those trees now, and they'll really grow. I have some, I planted one at home.
Right.
I had to cut it down in 10 years. It just, it got rid of
that. Right.
It's
encouraging.
Let me start with some of my cones.
What about the question of replanting forests as it bumps up against the principle of crop rotation? Here we're treating forests like soybeans or something. You plant it, you harvest it, you replant it, you harvest it.
Mm-hmm.
But aren't we going to run into the same situation? Aren't you going to wear the soil out? Don't you need to rotate and put in something else to renew the soil?
I don't think you need to rotate. As I mentioned the other day, Minnesota guys tell me they're on its third forest. And that is a question that comes up about depletion of the soil nutrients, the same species over and over and over again. I don't think they've got a lot of real good research or a lot of good answers on it. But it's a question they're studying pretty heavily.
Yeah. Howard, they're doing a lot of nitrogen fertilizing out in Oregon.
All right.
They've got some plots that are 40 years old now, where they've fertilize it every 3 years, and they go in with a helicopter, and they've isolated those plots, and they show fantastic.
They grow better, huh?
So they are working on it and checking it.
Are these in Weyerhaeuser's own plots or somebody else's?
And then they'll go in and they'll thin it. They'll kill maybe every third or fourth tree.
They'll kill them, or will they harvest them? Or they harvest
them?
Well,
if they're within 4 inches or greater, they'll harvest them. Otherwise, they just kill them.
4 inches or greater.
Yeah.
Fence posts.
So they're doing fantastic work up there, and they've got a lot of, in fact, GP's got a lot of test plots also.
All the big, large industrial companies, there are about 8 of them actually, Weyerhaeuser's the largest, of course, but they are quite advanced in their research and testing and application. And I read just recently, for instance, Weyerhaeuser, I think, had planted their 2 billionth seedling. Yeah. And they started that when I was in forestry school. In 1940, they were talking about timber is a crop, timber is a crop. Mm-hmm. Planet, planet, planet. And it's taken this many years to get it around, but if they hadn't started back then, where would we be now? See, they are very well advanced.
The federal government's doing far less, but they're starting now.
What is the chemical extent of photosynthesis? Is it strictly CO2 back to oxygen, or does it involve other elemental conversions too?
I think there's some other conversions. There's some of this air pollution is causing difficulty with the photosynthesis. That's one of the problems they have.
Does it get into any form of nitrogen production, for example?
I don't think so.
No. So there's nothing natural about nutrient regeneration with the trees chemistry.
In fact, somebody was putting bark down. I think bark is a nitrogen robber. So if you put that around your trees, it won't help.
So is sawdust.
Yeah, it's a nitrogen robber.
Yeah.
You had a question.
Mr.
Weyerhaeuser, yeah, he's right here.
But
I just worked for him.
Back in the 50s. When they had the Connie Pruitt, I can't remember who was around, Redmond, Bellevue, around there. But we're working along the road there, and there was about 6-8 fellas out in the woods out there, picking up these little pine cones, about the size of little finger, little green cones.
Mm-hmm.
We asked what they did with them. They picked them up because they said they're going into the timber companies for their replanting.
They do. They grow a lot of
what type of cone? I don't know if it came off a preferred tree or what. Just a little green cone.
I don't know. You know more about the cone size.
I don't know why they're picking up green ones, but the Douglas fir doesn't have a very large cone. They might have been fir cones.
Well, it's just little small.
Real small ones?
Little dinky ones.
I don't know.
And they were just scooping them up.
Getting
off
the seeds out of them.
See, that's the tree. They're filling bag after bag.
Well, now on the ethics notion, what I've just heard about this nitrogen lobby, how could Weyerhaeuser in good conscience sell waste bark for home use in tree plots and flower gardens and the like, knowing undoubtedly that it has this impact?
Well, it's not that great a deal for ornamentals. I mean, it holds the weeds down, which is a greater benefit than
the
nitrogen.
The weeds. And
they don't sell fertilizer.
They do sell bark.
Yeah. They sell a lot of bark.
There was a word there that I didn't know what it meant, photosynthesis. Somebody explain what it is, please.
Well, do you know what chlorophyll is?
Yes.
That's what makes the leaves green, and that's the process whereby the sunlight and the other chemicals are converted into usable food for the tree. And it goes down the tree to the roots. And it's a very common word, photosynthesis. And some of these air pollutants affect the chlorophyll, and that affects the process, its chemical process. That's why trees are important to be green.
Well, and the point is the byproduct of the photosynthesis is oxygen. Is that not
yes,
correct?
One of them. Yes. Trees give off oxygen. They take in carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
That's why trees, if you didn't even want to produce them for any other reason, to help purify the atmosphere, suddenly been recognized as the thing we ought to be doing. And a couple of these articles say we ought to be planting them along the roadways and everywhere there's land. Plant trees.
But some of them along roadways, they don't get along with the road.
They don't in Minnesota because we salt our highways all winter long and then we plow them up on the trees and they turn brown. It's kind of a counterproductive situation, but they also rot your car all to pieces, all that salt.
Isn't it the drier snow than we get out of here?
Back in Minnesota? Are you a skier?
No, my daughter.
Yeah, it's no, it's.
My daughter is working
good snow.
Up in Edmonton. She's never had a chain on her car. She's driving around there all the time, all the winter.
And not that dry. We need chains.
I don't. It's so dry. It's just like being on sand.
Again, on this notion of the bottom line of these things.
Garrison Keillor's got to meet him.
No, they really do that. It's just,
yeah, that's great.
They use.
No, Minnesota, it's bad. We need everything we can get. We had tire lugs for a long time, and they outlawed those finally. Yes.
What is the general consensus again of all this documentation as to the probability, assuming the good news, the good guys will win out? Let's take that premise. Will it be that natural resources are finally husbanded properly and brought into balance with consumption, or will it, in fact, will the good news story only end when the white knight of synthetics and nuclear come by to bail out the need, the requirement for these things? What are the
bail out the requirement for? What, for cellulose or for paper,
well, take,
or wood,
take,
or
take
what?
Take the energy component, for example. The third world who needs something to cook on and something to keep warm with. Will they end up with a little portable nuclear stove before they have wood?
Well, they've known the problem's been there for 40 years and they haven't done too much about it. There was a big drive to reforest South Korea. They've got some, after Korean War, they've got some good pictures now on what's happened there. That's been one of the shining examples in the world. And that came about through a lot of just plain planting trees. Those people now have wood to cook with. So it's possible to do it. But I don't know whether the change will come about.
But I immediately conjure up a strong autocratic monolithic government mandating you will plant trees, you will do this, you will do that. When you say South Korea, that same kind of autocratic approach could say you will have a small nuclear capability in your kitchen that will do the same things for you. What I'm really getting at is what is the...
First you got to have a kitchen.
Well...
The third world.
Yeah. Of the options.
I know
what
you're going to
do.
Yeah.
What do the smart people say is going to win the race and all this?
I don't know. I was reading these, state of the world, these projections for the next 50 years, and they show graphs up to 2020, and they don't show anything like that coming on the scene. They kind of allude to my point.
Yourself in the very first session a few days back talking about new generations of nuclear power that will prove their worth and will gain acceptance. And we'll be back full bore into nuclear energy.
Yep.
I believe we will. I have no doubt.
I think there's a real good case for that. The nuclear power, the new improved method of handling and everything,
sure.
And nuclear power may usurp the others and come into being.
20 years in Three Mile Island will be just a history book item.
I don't know. Do you have any opinions on that?
You go over to Europe and you see it right now.
Oh, sure.
ask people from France.
Yeah,
France is a good example.
And
still haven't solved the waste problem.
No. We've got to purify the nuclear waste. If we could do that, we'd have it, wouldn't we?
No problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just becoming a big problem now.
What does it take, about 10 years, 9 or 10 years to build a nuclear plant They've got two old bodies that were built and never turned on. They've been taking them apart. There's one at in Michigan, the Dow Chemical and Consumers Power had. And there's one in the Boston area or somewhere.
How about Washington? No,
we have two that are 75% done. Whoops.
The guy that lectures here a lot, Leo Bustead, you ever heard him
when
he's been here?
I know Leo, sure.
He's a world-renowned consultant who tells this humorous story, I think. That the Swedes hired him as a consultant. They were hemming hawing whether they'd build a nuclear plant over there. And he finally got so exasperated, he said, now look it. It takes about 9 years to build a nuclear plant. He said, you can't get a baby in 1 month by getting 9 women pregnant.
See, that's the problem with the nuclear, whatever developments, I mean, is what are we going to do with the waste? And we haven't solved that problem. The reason we haven't solved it is because nobody wants the repository, especially the people in Nevada.
Are we getting, you read, you know, you can't believe everything you read, but are we getting closer?
Well, Congress has said there is one place for study, and that's Yucca Mountain in Nevada. It's adjacent to the test site where they have tested all the nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And that is the only place now that's under consideration for the storage facility.
Okay, on making the waste less dangerous, are we making progress on that on a scale of 10? Are we down to 8 or anything?
Well, I'm not in the waste business, so I don't know.
Very few states wanted even to go through their state.
I don't know.
And they won't even let it pass through in a truck.
Or New Mexico has a facility called the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or the WIP site. By Carlsbad. Mm-hmm. Okay, so everybody's all upset, you know. The Department of Energy says, well, it's safe. And everybody says, no, it's not safe. Okay? And so until we can do something, until we can find, quote, a safe thing to do, I think there's always going to be controversy over nuclear energy.
This is getting off the subject, but it's a fascinating one, obviously. I don't understand why we haven't made any progress in entrapment of that stuff. We know what...
What they do with it now is they put it embedded in glass, put it in stainless steel containers, bury it in... Where are they? Stainless steel... with a concrete sleeve and a lid. How thick was that lid? I think the lid is at least 4 feet thick. Okay? It's all done by remote control. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's mechanical entrapment. What I'm saying is I don't understand why we don't do it through nuclear entrapment.
What is nuclear entrapment?
What we need is fusion.
Well, it's
fusion, point. Yeah. There's a couple of guys out here that figured it out, weren't there?
Encase it in the meltdown of the surrounding.
Yeah.
And you just put one big layer of glass and steel around that?
To tell you about the kind of controversy you get into all these things, just like on land exchange, for instance, on reforestation, they talk about the Federal Forest Service swapping land with the state parks and getting larger blocks and everything. And you get in, even with the Native Americans, that they get into very, very difficult situations when you're trying to solve just a minor problem on land exchange. I was in this one meeting, he was talking about it, and this one guy, it was a serious meeting, he says, the Bible says, the meek shall inherit the earth, but not the mineral rights.
At most 49%.
And that itself is enough to stop a land exchange because the mineral rights are everything that's hanging on the thing, you know. Well, just to get on a little further with this, I don't know of the issues. We're having a good conversation on the situation we're talking about here. Just to give you an idea of of the need for keeping the production of timber and fiber going. The United States, for instance, we use 13.7 billion cubic feet of wood.
A year?
A year. 13.7 billion feet. The stats you read is how much of that comes from our national forest and how much comes from private forests and other places. There's 1.8 million people employed with a $14 billion payroll. I just give you these stats because it shows that on a national scale what we're talking about. Out here they talk about the spotted owl closing up a plywood mill and so forth and 150,000 jobs. Well, here we're talking about 1.8 million people, $14 billion on the payroll. We use 20 million railroad ties a year, 6 million poles, and I don't know how many laminated timbers, huh?
Lots of.
Lots of laminated
timbers. Those last two were clearly destined for obsolescence.
Obsolescence. The railroad tie, this is comes up quite a bit in the Midwest. I don't know why we ever wasted so much really good, clear oak timbers on railroad ties.
Oak.
Oh, yeah.
It's the use. There's oak.
Oh, yeah.
And it'd be much better off if we'd make church pews out of that good, attractive oak. Concrete ties are coming in, but they're coming in very slowly. They don't have the resiliency of wood. A lot of research has been done on that over the years.
Well, they use them in Britain, don't they?
They use them in Europe, yeah, quite a bit, yeah. They don't have as many miles of railroads we have. And over there also, they may put a passenger train on one line and a freight train on another. The thing that's hurt our ties is we're overloading these freight cars so heavily now that they just about push the rail ahead of themselves as they go along.
Just like we do with the highways. Huh?
Yeah, that's right. Loading the trucks.
On the rail now, the freight gets the privilege. It goes first, then comes a passenger.
Oh, yeah, in the U.S.
Second choice.
Amazing thing, though, you know, people think they've got everything figured out. Here you're talking about 6 million utility poles. When I was in forestry school 45 years ago, they said, don't think about a career in the pole industry. Everything's going underground. That's going to be remote and transmitted, so there's nothing there for you. And I spent my whole career in the utility pole industry, you might say, and impregnating them. So how good are all the forecasts we make, you know? They tried quite a bit of the telephone line, a lot of the long lines of telephone are underground, but that's about it. Okay, anybody got any other questions about any particular phase of this? I can summarize it then just a little bit by saying that in the U.S. Now, I think both statewide, federally, and industrially, as I said the other day, if we can approach the private non-industrial landowner, which controls about 40% of our forested land, we would have it covered. And we've got pretty in place quite effective programs on all of those fronts. So the U.S. is doing a good job of replanting. The replanting now is not decided mainly on raising more fiber. It's decided on fish and wildlife, on the aesthetics, and all the other ingredients, including cleaner air, that go into a good forest management plan. The bottom line means a lot, legislation means a lot, and those are the things that contribute to good programs. The United States has been a model, I think, for the rest of the world. Some nations like Sweden have been ahead of us, but by and large, I think now we're taking good care of our forests. You'll read some statistics that we're not cutting as much as we're growing, but some of those are misleading because our growth is taking place on small new plantations and what we're cutting down are maybe the bigger trees. So there's going to be a gap in there when we need more saw timber until the new plantations come up to a larger size. But we are, in most areas and in most species, growing as much new board footage every year as we're cutting. And that's what we call being in balance. The biggest complaint...
That's all species?
Pardon me?
That's
That's all species?
I don't think it's on all species. You can get the stats on species for species. I'd say Douglas fir probably were not. I'm not too sure on that. But in the south, it's the other way around. We're growing southern a lot more pine. In southern pine. Yeah. Southern pine, we're growing a lot more than we're cutting. The big emotional complaint we're getting is selling our logs overseas, our prime timber. The biggest import we have, or we get most of our timber, though, is from Canada, and the Canadians are fighting with themselves about selling all their logs to the United States. They want to make timber out of it before they send it down here. What's promoted that, of course, is the differential in the dollar, where 20-25% dollar exchange. So a lumberman in Canada sells his lumber in the United States, he gets an extra $25 for every dollar he sells. So that's pushed
them. All the trees in Canada are controlled by the government too, aren't they?
Yeah, the stumpage up there is much cheaper. In the United States, people complain that the Forest Service is giving away our trees that are under cost, but they're competing with the Canadian people who might have a stumpage price of $3 a thousand, and it's costing us $12 or $15 a thousand. So there's a lot of good arguments on all sides of that question, too. So I think with that, we'll conclude for today, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you again, Howard.
Thank you.
Excellent.